This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. As a follow-up to our recent program about the size of your nest egg, Kathleen and I thought we would probably address how you build that nest egg. So, what should you be investing in? And are there different strategies for different phases of your life? That's what we're going to get into on the nitty-gritty on today's program.
We're going to start off by going over the most common rule of thumb for how your assets should be allocated. This rule of thumb is related to different ages. And we're going to then talk about whether or not there are any exceptions to this rule. So here's the most common rule of thumb for asset allocation based on your age. Your bonds to stock ratio in your portfolio is related to your age, with your percentage in bonds being your current age and with the remainder being in stocks. So if you're 20 years old, you have 20% of your portfolio in bonds and 80% in stocks. If you're 30, you have 30% in bonds and 70% in stocks. If you're 40 years old, you have 40% in bonds and 60% in stocks, etc., etc., etc. Now, I'm guessing that most of you listening right now probably have some sort of investment option in your 401k plan that sounds a lot like this. And these are called target retirement date funds. And in these funds, the mutual fund manager is the person responsible for moving the fund more and more toward bonds the older that you get. And I'm also guessing that a lot of you listeners out there have been to a financial planner who sat down with you with a pie chart that basically had the same exact principle happening. Jim, I think to me this makes a lot of sense, that when you're younger, you can be more heavily weighted toward high-risk assets, and as you get older, you move toward more low-risk assets. But I don't know, it seems pretty simplistic. Is there something I'm missing here, Jim?
Well, I think there's probably a couple things missing from this rule of thumb. One would be risk tolerance. And Kathleen, that varies by individual. It's not just an age issue. Now, one would suspect the older that you get, your tolerance for risk lessens because obviously you don't want to take big risk or big chances the older you get. So risk tolerance is probably at the top of the list. I think another factor that comes into play is size of your overall portfolio. And of course, we mustn't forget the current market environment. Just take a look at what we went through in the last 13 years. Two major significant bear markets in stocks that were as much as 40 and 50% declines. And not until April of this year have we seen a period of time where basically for 13 years, if you were in, let's say, an S&P index fund, your index fund virtually went nowhere. The stock market topped out at 1,500 in January of 2000. It topped out again at 1,500 in September of 2007. And not until the spring of this year did we finally exceed 1,500. So let's talk about risk tolerance first. Yes, technically, if you're a younger individual, you should be able to invest in riskier assets because you have more time to save. Let's face it, if you're younger, you can ride through a market correction or a bear market, especially if you've got 30, 40 years ahead of you, you can make up for any sizable downturns in your investments. However, if you have that low risk tolerance, just say you're conservative by nature, this is probably going to drive you crazy. So if you're younger and you can't handle risk well, you probably need to rethink about whether or not you're willing to just grit your teeth, take a little bit more risk, maybe don't look at your statements as often, and try to make your retirement savings goals, or whether you're going to end up focusing on more, let's say, conservative investments, which could possibly push out your retirement date a lot longer.
Jim, this reminds me a lot of a young couple that we met with recently. And when we first met with them, they first started investing with us several years ago, it was right after the 08 crash. And so even though they were very, very young at the time they first came to us, they were really good savers, had a pretty good portfolio already built up. They told me they really didn't have much of a stomach for risk. And we talked about whether or not that made sense for them given their age, but they were pretty adamant they didn't really want high risk in their portfolio. So we put them in a moderate risk portfolio. Well, they recently came up to me and said, hey, you know what? We want to grow our portfolio more. So now we're ready to take on more risk. So something else to think about too is that just because you're at one risk situation at one point in your life, that can change as your attitudes towards risk change, or maybe your financial situation changes, or maybe your retirement plans change. So this particular couple went from being a very low risk young couple to being more of a high risk young couple.
Ian, I want to move on to something else that's very important here. Size of assets makes a difference. Now, Kathleen and I have talked about, obviously, the younger that you start savings, putting money away for investments, whether it's both of you in a 401k program, and especially if the company's matching it, obviously, you need to put away less, and you're going to have a lot more given the time frame of having those assets compound over a longer period of time. Now, the thing that has a lot to do with the risk that you take also has to do with the size of your assets. For example, we have clients who are, for example, because of their risk tolerance, are overweight in metals. Now, this is probably something I don't typically encourage individuals. In fact, if you listen to the weekend show, we often have experts on, from people like Dr. Mark Faber to Felix Zuloff, who talks about no more than putting 20% of your assets in precious metals. And that would be on the aggressive side. Obviously, if you're conservative, that number would be less. But if you can afford to lose 50% of your investable assets and still be able to live the lifestyle that you're used to, well, maybe you can probably go ahead and take a lot more risk and maybe be overweight metals or maybe be overweight stocks. On the other side of the coin, if you have a sizable enough portfolio, you were fortunate enough to save early, you made good investments, maybe the company made matching contributions, you were very successful investments or in your business and you sold it, and you have a sizable portfolio. Start thinking in the neighborhood of $4 or $5 million all the way to $10 million plus. And let's say now, given the size of those assets, you're risk adverse. Well, you can invest in a laddered bond portfolio and you're going to generate enough income to meet your income needs and probably some money left over. So your portfolio may not grow as much. Let's say somebody invested in a blue chip dividend paying stock, but if you're just trying to preserve it, you want to be comfortable, you're getting enough income, well, maybe this is something that fits you as well.
I think people would be pretty lucky, Jim, if they have $5 million to $10 million stashed away. I'm thinking about those investors who maybe don't have a lot saved up already. Maybe the millennial generation, which as we know is way behind the savings curve, or maybe someone who did start saving but then got pretty wiped out by the 08 crash. What about someone in that situation whose asset level is maybe not as high as that?
Once again, I think the tendency, especially in age and the time span, let's say the further away you are from retirement, there's a tendency in cases to focus solely on return and forget about risk. I see a lot of investors who have less savings than they think they should, who decide, okay, let's go for it. We're going to decide to pursue risky investments to try to make up the difference. And especially some people that might have lost some money in a bear market. And what they hope is that by generating and getting into riskier type investments, they'll get the kind of higher returns that are going to help get them to their retirement goals. So maybe they focus on, let's say, smaller cap stocks, or they're focusing on investments that have been performing well, chasing the things that have done well in the market in a particular time. So there is a tendency that rather than looking at the investment's life cycle to see if, should I be heavily invested in this area? Is it a good time to buy? They're more apt to buy into investments after already they've had a big run-up. I call it the Money Magazine syndrome, where every year they talk about a forecast for the year ahead, and they talk about the funds that did very well in the previous year, or maybe the previous 6 months. So they're focusing more on short-term performance rather than long-term performance, which is what investors really need to do. So on one hand, it's possible to be too conservatively invested, where the assets you're investing in may not be offering enough return to get your portfolio where it needs to be by the time you retire. So the balance, and then we always have to talk about balance here, between risky and conservative assets in your overall portfolio should make sense for your own unique situation. Because let's face it, folks, we're all different. you have a lot different tolerance for risk. You may be an individual that's quite comfortable with risk. You've been investing in the market over a long period of time. You're very adept at reading charts, macroeconomics. So maybe you're more willing to go out on the risk side because your own experience. Or maybe you're fortunate enough. You have a larger size asset base, and maybe your goals may be different. You may live very modestly, save a lot. We run into that. So all of these things make up a different type of investment plan. It's not the simple pie chart. You either go to a financial planner, you go to a brokerage office, you say, I'm getting ready to retire. They're going to give you a nice, pretty little folder with all the little pie charts that have this standard formula. The problem is everybody does not have a standard retirement. Everybody's a little different from the asset size to the risk tolerance. And here's one. What about the difference between spouses? What if one spouse is more comfortable with taking risk, maybe through their own experience and knowledge, the other spouse isn't? So there's even issues, even between spouses, where you have differences in risk tolerance.
Well, getting back to this whole idea of this rule of thumb, Jim, and you've talked about how important it is that people really take a look at this to see if it makes sense for their situation, because like you mentioned, everybody's a little bit different. But this rule of thumb is really all about the stocks to bonds ratio. And I know that you and Rob Bernard spend a lot of time on every Financial Sense NewsHour weekend show going over the bond market. And we've had a lot of interest in laddered bond portfolios as a result. So I've just been noticing that laddered bond portfolios, sometimes they don't always make sense for certain situations.
No, I mean, everybody's different. Laddered bonds are, for example, a good option for people who are, let's say, more concerned about the return of their principal rather than the returns that they're making on that principal. They also can provide stability to a portfolio. Let's say the stock market's going through a correction. Well, it's kind of nice to have bonds, because typically what you'll see is the bond market may rally. Why risk increase? So people are more concerned. So that way you don't have everything in one area of the market. So they can provide stability. And also, the one thing that they're known for and why they're used in pension plans and retirement plans is they can provide you with predictable income. But bond yields are still at or near historic lows. Folks, I mean, if we were having this conversation 13 years ago, did you ever think that you would see interest rates at the bank where the bank's giving you basically a quarter of a percent or a half a percent on your money, or you'd be invested in a money market fund when you would get 0%. Bond yields are at historic lows. Now, when I talk about bonds being at historic lows, what does that imply? It implies there's interest rate risk. And interest rate risk comes from the fact that if interest rates are low and they start to go up, anyone that's buying a bond now is probably buying it at near the lowest yield for a bond. A similar bond a year from now is likely to be offering, let's say, a higher yield or a higher income level. I mean, if we just go back to last summer. Last summer, and I'm talking about the summer of 2012, when bond yields got to their bottom, their NEEP, and there we saw bond yields get down to about 1.4%. If you take a look at where we are this Friday, we're at 2.75. Here's a good example. And we may see that going forward because we believe we're in an upward rising interest rate market. Now, it's not going to happen overnight, but over a period of time, over the next couple decades, we are more likely to see rising interest rates. Just as, for example, when I got in this business in 1980, we were just reaching almost the pinnacle of interest rates where we would see the yield, imagine this, folks, on a 10-year treasury note get almost 16%. Well, it took us from 1981 all the way to the summer of 2012 to go from 16% all the way down to almost 1.4%. So in a similar fashion, 2 years from now, you could see bonds that are offering a higher yield than what they're offering today. So by tying yourself up in a bond now at a low interest rate, you're giving up some of the opportunity to use those same assets to buy a bond at a higher interest rate in a year or maybe a few years from now. And every time interest rates go up, the market value of an existing lower interest paying bond, well, they're going to go down. Now, this doesn't change the value of the bond at maturity. If you bought a $10,000 bond, it matures in 10 years. 10 years from now, you're going to get your $10,000 back. But it does mean that if you had to sell the bond before it matured, in an interest rate environment where current interest rates are climbing like they are now, then your bond would be selling at less than what you paid for. Again, a different story if you hold it to maturity. If you do have to sell early, you could run the risk of interest rate risk, meaning that your bond would be less than you paid for it.
We've talked a little bit about the income potential of these bonds, Jim, and how the interest rates would go up and down and affect the overall value of the bond. But I know that for a lot of our investors, inflation risk is a concern for them too. So let's just take an example. If we have a bond that we purchase now and it's paying 3%, and if it's a 10-year bond, and let's say it was paying you $3,000 a year now at a 3% yield, if we took a look at that bond, let's say we picked up that bond back in 2003, $100,000 bond paying 3%, $3,000 a year. We've been holding that bond all this time to 2013. The inflation effect on that bond is that $3,000 worth of income you've been getting back in 2003, you have to have almost $3,800 or more to have the same purchasing power as that $3,000 back in 2003. So if you're holding a bond, you do get steady income, but you also take that risk of inflation income because most bonds' income yields aren't indexed to inflation. There are a few out there that are indexed to inflation, but they're not all that common. So right now, this rule of thumb that when you're 60, you should be 60% in bonds and 40% in stock could mean that you're not only taking the interest rate risk that Jim was talking about, but you're also taking inflation risk. So an allocation of bonds right now may really mean that you have to figure out what your specific focus and your specific purpose is for investing in a bond right now, because they're carrying unique risks. And as a quick aside, our industry regulator, FINRA, published a really great guide for those of you who are new to investing in individual bonds. And it's called Smart Bond Investing. It's available at their website, finra.org. That's FINRA.org, Smart Bond Investing.
You know, this reminds me in the early 1980s when I first got in the business, when CDs were paying 12%. Gosh, I can remember bonds. In fact, that's all we did primarily for many investors back then, because people were saying, you know, if I could get 12, 13, 14% as investors were getting in things like Ginnie Mae's, you know, why do I want to take the risk? And bonds were very, very high return assets back then. In other words, you were getting a high rate of return that was well above the inflation rate. Now, in that kind of environment, high interest rates, it probably made a lot more sense to be heavily weighted towards bonds than stocks. I mean, folks, I can remember in, gosh, this goes back to the early 80s, and it was pretty much constant throughout the 80s until probably Alan Greenspan came in and began to slash interest rates during the 91 recession, which really got rid of double-digit interest rates. But from the time I got in business in the 80s, we could get Ginnie Mae's, those were government-backed, mortgage-backed securities backed by the U.S. government, 12 to 14%. You could get tax-free bonds at 9%. Corporate bonds were double digits, and I'm talking about high-quality bonds. And you could also get things like conservative utility stocks. I can remember getting 12, 13% on utility stocks. In fact, when President Reagan first came to office, there was a special tax exemption in the Recovery Act that he passed in 1981 that exempted $1,500 of dividends from taxation. So those were the good old days, and a lot more people were invested in bonds because of the high rate of returns. So, you know, when you take a look at these pie charts, these rules, yes, they're reflective of somebody's age, but they're also reflective of an investment environment. So the problem with these rules of thumb relating to your age or the percentage of bonds in your portfolio are that it doesn't take into account not only your own tolerance for risk, your size of your assets, and more importantly, the current market environment. How many of you today, given the low rate of inflation that we're experiencing, would love to go back to the 80s where we had, let's say, 3, 4% inflation rates, but you had double-digit interest rates? You got that interest rate guaranteed at the bank, guaranteed in a government bond or a high-quality corporate bond. Oh, we'd all love to go back to that era, but that's not the market environment we live in today.
I'm also thinking, Jim, about, I know that you interviewed Wade Fow, I think back in April of this year, about this whole allocation model. And there is a lot of thinking out there that says when you retire at around 60, 65, that you should have that 60 to 65% in bonds, 40 to 35% in stocks. And that's kind of your baseline for where you pull out that 4% target withdrawal rate for the remainder of your retirement. And Wade's research was showing that some of those assumptions behind that allocation model and that withdrawal model are really skewed and quite wrong. In fact, he was saying that there are cases in which an immediate annuity combined with bonds and stocks is going to make the most sense for making sure that a couple has assets to last them throughout their entire lifetime.
And one of the reasons he did that, Kathleen, is most people that are invested, individual investors that are institutions, tend to have laddered bond portfolios, whether it's a pension plan, an insurance company, or a bank. But individuals, primarily, if they're invested in bonds, they're invested in a bond fund. And when you're invested in a bond fund, there is no guarantee because there is no maturity. And likewise, there is no guarantee of income. If you take a look at the last 13 years with declining interest rates, if you were invested in a bond fund, let's say in the year 2000, your income probably dropped by 50 or 60% by the end of the decade as interest rates came down. So I think a lot of that came from his looking at bond funds, which is how investors typically, individual investors, invest when they invest in the bond market. And I think this is where this rule of thumb model really falls down. As you approach retirement, if you'll be living partially off your savings, you need to start repositioning your assets for the specific income you're going to need to have in retirement. Now, this brings us back to the budget. Now, especially as you approach retirement, remember, we always talk about taking your budget and dissecting it into different categories. Having a budget, for example, that breaks down the things that you need to have, the basics in life. This is what it costs to live on a day-to-day basis. Then there's a portion of your budget, the sort of want-to-haves. Okay, now that I'm retired, outside my living expenses, I'd like to join a country club, play more golf, maybe do more travel, more boating. And then we have what we call the wish-to-have stuff. Hey, I want to get a new motorhome, new boat, or something like that. Now, why does this matter? As we've discussed probably over the last several weeks, each of these three parts of your budget should be funded by different type of assets. And as you approach retirement, you want to make sure your basic need-to-have budget, this is what it costs to live, that you start positioning your assets, and you want to make sure that that portion of your budget is very secure. You can count on it. It's not going to change if the market changes. It's not going to change if the Fed changes strategy. So you start repositioning your assets towards these different types of needs in your budget. Now, a while back, we talked about a case study, Bill and Jane Smith, who we introduced to you in July of last year. And the reason we bring this up, because it illustrates some of the points that we're trying to get across here. Now, the Smiths had a shortfall in their budget of roughly, let's call it a little over $33,000. Now, about $18,500 of that shortfall was basic living expenses and investment assets of around $990,000. Now, the way we solved this problem is we put about $500,000 in a laddered bond portfolio at roughly 4%. That was going to provide Bill with the steady, predictable source of income. Remember, Bill had lost a lot of money in his IRA rollover, which he did in 2006. And then, of course, we know what happened in 2007, 8, and 9. We put another $220,000 in dividend-paying stocks, earning about 3%. And then we did a single life annuity on Jan for about $230,000 that came from her 403B plan that she had put in place as a teacher. And if you're not familiar, a 403B plan is kind of similar to what many of us in the private sector know as a 401K plan. So we needed to do that because there were two things. One, there was an 8-year age difference between Bill and Jan. Number two, Jan's family lived a long time, both her parents into the 90s. And also Bill had a heart problem, heart disease that he had been dealing with. So this allocation gave them a surplus of income of over $17,000 and also left them a cash cushion of $40,000 for those emergencies that we all know come up and crop up. And there were a number of ways we could have solved the shortfall. We could have, for example, put $600,000 in a 3% dividend-paying stock portfolio of blue chips, maybe $390,000 in 4% bonds. However, the solution we chose was one that they wanted to meet their specific situation. They wanted certainty. Jan wanted to know that if Bill preceded her, she was going to have the income to maintain the lifestyle, stay in the home that they were currently living in, and she would be able to remain in that home throughout her retirement years, which could take her well into the 90s. And likewise, Bill had been worried about the downturn in 2008. Folks, remember, think of what would happen if you had, let's say, an $830,000 IRA that dropped down to over $600,000. So he wasn't comfortable with an allocation that was heavily exposed to stocks. And like I said, we could have put them in a solution that was around 40% bonds and 60% stocks. But let me tell you, Bill would have worried about it the entire time. So that didn't make a lot of sense. We could have also placed them in roughly 60% bonds or 40% stocks and had maybe a surplus of $2,200 a year. So the surplus or margin of error would have been a lot less. So Bill probably would have been comfortable with this from a risk standpoint. But let's put it this way. Bill and Jan needed something that was more aware of inflation, especially given the 8-year age difference between Bill and Jan, longevity in Jan's side of the family. And it also took into account their age difference, and also their portfolio had to last not only for Bill's estimated 25 years of retirement, but also Jan's life expectancy as well, which is where the single life annuity came in. So in this case, the investment portfolio was not only more tuned to the different aspects of their life, from basic necessities to, let's say, want-to-haves to wish-to-haves, but also their risk tolerance as well, and also given the size of their portfolio.
Jim, I think Bill and Jan's example really highlights the need for a strategy that's specific to a unique situation. We talked a few weeks ago about rules of thumb for savings targets for your retirement nest egg, but these are general rules of thumb. They don't take into account specific market environments or the individual investor or each person's individual situation. So I think the way to look at all these rules of thumbs that Jim and I have been giving you is to look at them as measuring sticks or rulers to some extent, but not as rules. So look at these as sample rulers, but not rules. And the bottom line is that any savings or investment strategy you have, it needs to be purposeful. Jim and I have talked many times about how each portion of your portfolio needs to have a specific purpose, a specific reason for why you're holding that investment in your portfolio. It needs to be practical. In other words, it needs to be something that makes sense for the current market environment and for your tolerance for risk and for your goals. And it needs to be personal. It needs to be something that's tailored for your specific family's needs, wishes, wants, goals, assets, expectations, all those things. So as we give you these rules of thumb, these are just general measuring sticks. You'll definitely want to meet with someone and have a personal strategy drawn up just for you.
Exactly. And because, once again, investing in riskier assets solely for the sake of growth is not purposeful. You need to consider a worst-case scenario. Think again of what happened between 2000 and 2002 or 2007 and 2009. And not just the best-case scenario, because many times a lot of these pie chart and rules that you get, these standard programs, are assuming a best-case scenario over a long period of time. And yes, a heavier weighting towards riskier assets can make sense, but there should be a specific reason for why you're making that decision, since the risk of loss tends to be higher. Now, weighting more towards conservative investments may make sense too, but then again, it depends on who you are as an individual. And let's face it, folks, the market is always changing. As we talked on last week's program, I call it high-frequency rotation. Stocks that did well in the first quarter of the year did not do well in the second and third quarter. And the stocks that did well in the third quarter, well, it's changing again. So the market is always changing. There will be times, like now, when being more heavily invested in stocks may make a lot more sense than being in bonds if you can handle the risk. And then there will be times when investing in bonds make more sense than stocks, very much like what we experienced in the first part of the 1980s, which lasted for almost an entire decade. So before you commit yourself to a strategy, see if it makes sense for you personally. Does it match your financial situation? Is it suitable to who you are and the type of risk that you feel comfortable taking? And does it make sense given the current market environment?
So remember the three P's: purposeful, practical, personal.
Now, we hope we've given you some food for thought on today's lifetime income. So on behalf of myself, Jim Poplava, and Kathleen Harris, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.